Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Common Anomaly Podcast. I'm your host, Stuart James. Joining me today is Clayton James. How's it going, brother?
Honestly, I'm not doing great.
No? How come? What's going on?
I'm sniffly. My throat's all scratchy. I think I got whatever it was you had before.
Yeah, sorry about that. Finally caught up to you, did it?
But I'm here, and I'm going to do my best.
We're going to make it work. We're off to a bit of a rocky start today. Technical problems, nothing's working. We're going to be pretty scattershot in terms of a show. I don't know about you, but I'm all over the map. I've got notes in 15 different places.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be great. Yeah, it'll all come together magically somehow. So what have we got today? I know we want to do some current events. There's some big news this week.
The Pope passed away on Monday.
Right on Easter Monday, yeah. Or was it over the weekend?
No, it was on Easter Monday.
Oh, wow.
And I was immediately struck by how heavy the symbolism of the Pope passing away on Easter, which is all about resurrection. Although Jesus technically was resurrected on Sunday, not Monday, but still, the holiday.
Zombie Jesus holiday.
And I was immediately, I was reminded of kind of a doomsday prophecy. Actually, it was the first thing it reminded me of. Have you ever heard of St. Malachi's prophecy of the popes?
Does not ring a bell, I can't say.
It's a bit obscure. It's a very old prophecy from the 12th century. This 12th century St. Malachi, he wrote this list of 112 future popes, you know, starting with the pope who was currently seated at the time. And he projected that forward and made a list of 112 future ones. And he didn't name them specifically. He didn't write down their names. He just wrote a like a phrase or a motto tied to each future pope.
Right.
And these phrases would kind of act almost as little confirmers in the future as people looked at this prophecy.
Okay.
And I've wrote down a few of them. I only wrote down three.
How is his track record? I mean, have they been accurate?
Debatable. I mean, prophecy
up for interpretation
is
sort of
always
thing.
Open to interpretation. Like, I'll read you a few. Like, Pope John Paul II.
All right.
This list, you know, where Pope John Paul II would fall in this list is a pope the prophecy refers to as from the labor of the sun. That's the phrase that's associated with that pope. Now, interesting little confirmer, some people see it as, that refers to John Paul II. John Paul II was actually born on the day of an eclipse, a solar eclipse.
Right.
And his funeral was held also on the day of a solar eclipse.
Okay. So, all right.
Of the labor of the sun.
Yeah.
Pope Benedict, where he would fall on this list, that pope is referred to as the glory of the olive. Now, Pope Benedict, he chose the name Benedict specifically to associate himself with peace and contemplation. Peace, the olive branch, the Benedictine order, their symbol, I believe, is an olive tree.
Okay, so connections. Yeah.
So after the glory of the olive is supposedly the final pope, according to this prophecy, which would be Pope Francis, who the prophecy refers to as Peter the Roman.
Okay. Pardon me. So Francis was the last pope, or the next pope is the last pope?
Oh, it's saying Pope Francis will be the last pope.
Okay. But it doesn't mention him by name, but according to this chronology, if our interpretations of these popes and these little paragraphs are correct, he would be the last one.
Yes. And the final pope in this prophecy is referred to as Peter the Roman. Something people have seen as a confirmer is Peter the Roman. Pope Francis, he's originally from Argentina, but he was the child of Italian immigrants, Italy, mm-hmm. Rome. So this prophecy, all it has is these little phrases or sayings. For the final pope, there's actually like a full paragraph written. And I've got it written down here. So this is what it says about the final pope. In the final persecution of the church, there will sit Peter the Roman. He will pasture his sheep in many tribulations. And when these things are finished, the city of the seven hills will be destroyed, and the dreadful judge will judge his people. The end.
Oh my. Just a little foreboding.
A little bit. So yeah. We'll see if... I don't know exactly how long it takes them to select a new pope, but yeah. We will see if Rome is destroyed in the coming weeks. I certainly hope not.
Is Rome the city of seven hills?
Or yeah, that's what that frequently refers to. Okay. Is the city of the seven hills. But yeah, I don't know how long it takes them to select a new pope. It varies.
Hopefully they drag it out. If that's at all accurate.
Yeah. It's usually once they start their selection process in recent times, it only takes them a few days. But historically, the selection has lasted as long as years.
Right. I was going to ask because I was like, I feel like I've already seen headlines where they're in the selection process or trying to.
Yeah. They wait, I think, 2 weeks after, you know, the death of the sitting pope, and then they have what's called a conclave, where they basically, these higher-ups in the church, they sequester themselves in this building, and they have some sort of selection process, and it can take from days to weeks to years sometimes.
Okay, so hopefully we have a little bit of time.
Hopefully.
Hopefully we have time to squeeze in that ghost hunt somewhere, at least.
Yeah.
High priorities.
Yeah, where are we at with that? Have we decided where we're going?
I feel like we've decided. Yeah, we've definitely gotten some audience feedback. Yeah. Thank you very much, folks, for those of you who chimed in and gave us your feedback. It does feel like all signs are pointing in a certain direction, which we won't reveal just yet. But yeah, I think we have our location. We just have to figure out timing. I know we were talking about maybe trying to accelerate our workflow here and try and get an episode for next week recorded earlier in the week so that we could go ghost hunting next weekend.
Yeah.
But, if you get severely under the weather, maybe we might have to push it a little further out.
You know,
we'll see how the week goes.
We'll see how the week goes. I'm hope it came on very suddenly. I hope it disappears just as quickly.
Me too. Yeah. I can tell you, for me, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that bad of a cold. It just moved into my chest. And then you get that horrible bronchitis cough, you know.
No one's got time for that.
It just hangs on forever. It's just brutal. But you should feel better within a couple days. Just start hitting that vitamin D, you know. Take your vitamin D, your K2. This is not medical advice, by the way, folks. I'm speaking to Clayton, not the audience.
Don't take medical advice from people on the internet.
But get your vitamins. That's all I got to say about that.
I always do.
Well, I wanted to. We talked a bit about getting back into like space anomalies and stuff like that last week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why we kind of ended up scattered. I spent most of my week. Well, for one thing, I was distracted. I was working on another secret project for the show, which we're not ready to reveal just yet, but maybe in a few weeks. It's still under development, but we got some projects we're working on for the show that we're working on in the background. But I really wanted to revisit what we touched on, the K2-18b discovery. And I feel like that's going to serve as a good launch platform. Yeah. See what I did there?
You're so funny.
Thank you. Into some Electric Universe stuff. How does that sound to you?
That sounds good.
How familiar are you with the Electric Universe?
I've heard of it.
There's some pretty wild stuff in there.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
I'm not super familiar with it. I've heard of it. I know kind of what it's about on a superficial level.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
Okay. Well, I'll attempt to fill in the gaps. I tell you what, it's a little dense, I have a hard time wrapping my brain around all aspects of it. And I feel like it gets, this is something I put in my notes as I was going through a bunch of that stuff earlier this week. I started to get a very Terrence Howard vibe. you know, the actor Terrence Howard.
No.
Never mind. Hopefully the audience will understand. He went on Joe Rogan and he's got a whole thing about sacred geometry and he gets, he's pretty out there stuff. But that's the vibe I was getting as I was digging into Electric Universe. But there's a lot of fun kind of stuff in Electric Universe. But first, why don't we go back? Because I feel like we didn't do it justice on the last episode. It was big news about 2 weeks ago. It's still very much in the news cycle. Just to summarize, an exoplanet around a red dwarf star 124 light years away, roughly in the constellation of Leo, that is labeled K2-18b. A team from Cambridge University announced that they found, within the light spectrum of its atmosphere, signs of a biosignature. So I don't know how much you know about how this works. It's the same way. It's basically the same method they use to detect exoplanets in the first place.
They analyze the light spectrum.
The light spectrum, that's right. And they can see, using very sensitive telescopes like James Webb, they can see the dip in light as a planet transits across the star. Basically, it's, you know, the planet moves between the star and the telescope, and it can read the dip in the light, right?
Yep.
That's how we find these planets that are, you know, hundreds of light years away around other stars. But they're so sensitive now that they can actually, as the planet is transiting, they can see that, you know, when you see pictures of the Earth from space, there's that blue kind of aura, glowing aura, right?
Yeah.
That's Earth's atmosphere, right? You're seeing the light pass through Earth's atmosphere. So we can actually take a picture of that around these transiting exoplanets. And from the light spectrum through the atmosphere, you can determine the contents of the atmosphere, what kind of chemical elements and gases are in the atmosphere. Absolutely peak human scientific achievement.
Absolutely.
It blows my mind that we can look at an object 124 light years away and see the chemical composition of its atmosphere. Absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's right? Pretty crazy.
And so we're looking at this world, K2-18b, and what do we see in the atmosphere? They found hydrogen dioxide, methane, carbon disulfide, dimethyl sulfide, and so dimethyl sulfide. So this is the big one. A number of these elements, again, that like methane is a biosignature.
Yeah, like methane and carbon dioxide, they're associated with
that's
biological
right.
processes.
It's not
on
a dead
Earth.
Ringer. It's not a dead ringer, but it's that dimethyl sulfide that I understand.
Dimethyl sulfide and dimethyl disulfide.
That's right. That's right. And them both together. That's a very strong indicator that there's biology happening.
Yeah. On Earth, those compounds are pretty much exclusively produced by marine life, like
that's
microbial
right.
marine life. And
yeah, so we're talking algae, cytoplankton.
But what we can
sort of
what we can tell about this planet, it's theorized that it's basically an ocean world. It's covered in water.
That's right. It's a supposed Hycean world. Or Hycean world. I'm not sure. I've heard it both ways. I'm going to go with Hycean. It's just the way it rolls off my tongue. So it is 8.6 times Earth's mass. Pardon me. So it falls into that classification of a super Earth or a mini Neptune. So, you know, it's somewhere in between the size of somewhere in the middle, right? It's not quite a gas giant, but it's not believed to have a rocky surface. It's an ocean surface and a largely hydrogen-based atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be a breathable atmosphere, but it's probably a liquid water ocean covering the surface of this planet. So, and the other really, as all things pop into the news, this was very controversial, right? And so a little what I wanted to dig into is just, because there was immediately people detracting this announcement, saying this is too sensational, this isn't good science. They, you know, you can't go to the bank with this result. But as I dug into it a little bit this week, I saw that, okay, you know, this Cambridge group, it's not like they're doing bad science. It seems like they're doing really good work. And this is their second attempt to verify this reading. They I guess, initially, can't speak today, initially made this detection back in 2022. And so this is a second attempt that they've gone back and they've reestablished this detection. So they've reproduced the result, basically, mm-hmm. right? Of course, you want other teams to do it. And from what I've seen, the detractors, the people kind of saying this is a little too sensational, is just because it's the degree of confidence, right? I forget their classification. Sigmas, right? It fits in the three sigma range confidence.
In terms of the detection of dimethyl sulfide and dimethyl disulfide, they are currently sitting at a confidence level of 99.7, which is considered sigma 4. Sigma 5 is basically considered scientific confirmation.
Yeah, so that would be...
That is 99.99994% certainty that what you've detected is actually there. And you have to replicate your results...
numerous times, yeah.
A few times to get to that level of certitude.
So it's really a question of just due diligence before saying this is absolute proof. So it's not absolute proof of life on another planet, but it is absolutely the strongest evidence to date that we have of life on another planetary body other than Earth.
Yeah.
That is very exciting. So I do think it does justify the hype. It does justify the announcement.
And I think it's really cool because I think when we look for evidence of life on other planets, I think we tend to be a bit chauvinistic about our own biology and the composition of our own planet. We're always kind of looking for something. We're looking for planets like Earth. We're looking for biosignatures that match ours.
Yeah.
But this planet is so different from Earth. And I think it would just be really cool to see like confirmation of life thriving in an environment so different from ours. I think that really expands the possibilities for life, as you always put it, being ubiquitous and taking on forms vastly different from ours and in environments vastly different from ours.
We already know the base ingredients are all over the universe, right? It's the same substrate everywhere, right? And yes, of course, regionally, it varies a lot. It's different. But the same core elements that build up everything we know to be living, it's everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And if it can happen in two places, it's got to be everywhere, right? Even if we discovered life or evidence for pre-existing life or current life on Mars, you could look at it from a panspermia angle and say, well, it still could be a single genesis, but we've just cross-pollinated within our own solar system. But this planet is 124 light years away.
Yeah.
It is truly evidence of a second genesis.
And just, you know.
And it's actually, in cosmic terms, not that far away.
Yeah, but in our terms, it is.
In our terms, yes. It's
for perspective, that distance, it would take over a million years for our fastest rocket to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
But on a cosmic time scale, that's not very long.
No, but just in terms of a discovery.
Yeah.
And I mean, it means then we can focus our telescopes more intently on this solar system and on this planet. And the other really interesting thing I found about it is it's a red dwarf system.
Yeah.
So it's often thought, because they're red dwarfs are very common. I think that's the most common star.
Yeah, despite like our star being called a main sequence star.
Yeah.
You hear that name and you think that's the most common main sequence. But no, red dwarfs are way more common.
Way more common, right? And it was thought that red dwarfs flare a lot. Mm-hmm. And so even planets in the habitable zone of a red dwarf star might not be able to support life because the flares would be too intense and the radiation would be too intense and it would strip away atmospheres from planets. But here we are, the best evidence, the best signal for a biosignature around another planet. It's a red dwarf system. So I've seen some commentary say, well, maybe we need to rethink how we're viewing red dwarf systems. Maybe they're sub-classifications. Maybe they all don't flare so violently.
Isn't just a little aside, isn't Proxima B a red dwarf? And weren't we just recently talking about mysterious signals coming from Proxima
B? Yeah, that's right. We were, yeah.
And much, is a red dwarf. Much closer, well. Yeah. Much easier for us to, you know, go poking around there.
Yeah, just as a little tangent I just want to make. You know what, when I saw this news initially, you know what memory it sparked in my brain? Do you remember Sim Earth?
Oh, yeah.
Remember I love that game. Remember playing Sim Earth on the computer or NES?
I was really terrible at it, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. So it's in the series of Sims games, which are now all about people.
Yeah, The Sims. But there was, you know, Sim City. Sim Ant, yeah. Sim Earth.
Sim Earth was my favorite because you always started with a blank slate that was just like an ocean with no land mass. And no life. Yeah, and little by little, it's like microbial life popped up. And then
you just throw asteroids at it.
That's right. Yeah, and that's how you get land. And then there's volcanic activity is how you get land mass. And then you start seeing aquatic species. And you kind of develop life on your planet. It made me think about that instantly. Because it feels like this might be a planet that's... I mean, because of its size and circumstance and its star, it might only ever be a world that can support cytoplankton and kind of basic single-celled marine life.
Well, you never know.
Or it could be just in that stage. At one point in Earth's history, that's probably all Earth could... That's all Earth had on it was microbial cytoplankton. And that was an epoch of time. And then more complex life developed later, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but this red dwarf thing... That for me sparked me into the electric universe. So before we get to that specific connection, let's just get the basics down. Let's get the basics down for the electric universe theory.
Okay.
Okay, so this is an alternate theory of cosmology, popularized by Doctors Thornhill and Talbot, as I understand. And it believes that the nature of... our universe and the fusion of stars is not actually a nuclear fusion.
Okay.
Everything is based off electromagnetics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they believe that gravity is such a weak force. Is gravity is actually just a, not driven by mass, but is a byproduct of electromagnetic forces.
Okay. Okay. So, right?
So the stars are not nuclear furnaces. They're like electrodes and a massive interconnected circuitry.
Oh, wow.
Of the galaxy, right? Wow, this is hard to explain. Okay. And so they theorize that Earth was once around a red dwarf star. We weren't always planet Earth was not always with the current star we have now, with Sol.
Oh.
Right? And they reference this by certain legends and mythos about the Earth being the same temperature, about the color of the sky being this kind of hazy purple. Right? And at some point, that star, our original red dwarf star, came in close proximity to our sun, to our current sun.
And Earth was captured.
And because our current sun, has a higher voltage. It was a bigger star, has a higher voltage. It basically deactivated the other star, the red dwarf.
So it deactivated the star entirely, or did it just break the connection we had to that star?
No, it deactivated the star, like shut it down.
Oh, so interesting.
It broke it down, and it turned into kind of a cometary body that lost a bunch of its gas.
Is it Planet Nine?
No.
Is this other star Planet Nine?
No, it's Venus.
Venus is the other
star. The red dwarf, you know, lost a bunch of its mass, was deactivated. It's no longer functioning as a star. And that's why Venus has, it spins the opposite
direction. Yeah, yeah.
It spins the opposite
direction. It's the only planet that does that.
Yeah, in our solar system.
Interesting.
And then, yeah, Earth and Mars got captured into this new solar system, as did the original red dwarf. So, where am I going with this?
So, just to recap, the common held belief is that, you know, gravity is the kind of central force, you know, on the large scale. On the small scale, it's the nuclear force. But really, electromagnetism and electricity play a much larger role in shaping and structuring all everything in the universe.
That's right.
That's the very superficial level understanding I have of it.
That's right. Yeah.
And plasma. I have yes. that highlighted in my notes.
Yeah. Plasma is a big thing, right? So
it sounds very similar to how Nikola Tesla saw the world.
It is. It is. Yeah. And they reference Tesla a lot, right? And yeah, they have these things called plasmoids, which is basically a self-contained cell of superheated plasma and an electromagnetic charge that it kind of, it's like ball lightning almost, right?
Okay.
So that's how they feel like stars actually are operating, right? Opposed to mass and gravity forcing fusion to generate other heavier elements and superheated plasma, right? So that's how they feel like it works. And you can recreate plasmoids in the lab. So there was some research done in 1956 by Winston H. Bostick. And so he was experimenting with electromagnetic fields and forced heated plasma. And he was able to recreate these plasmoid things in the laboratory. And what he found is that the way these behaved is they often started turning into these kind of self-orbiting spiral patterns.
Oh, interesting.
That look a lot like galaxies.
Oh, interesting.
Right? So his theory is that these were kind of micro-galaxies that they were creating in the lab. And that they would have a repulsive force. If he forced two of them to interact, that they would slow down and then repel away from each other when he tried to get them to interact, which is what we see, how we see galaxies behave. This is so his thought is this might explain why we see galaxies traveling away from each other in circumstances when they ought to be traveling in the same direction or towards each other.
You know, this all sounds very outlandish, but when you think about it, our current model for the universe is also kind of outlandish. Like, you have dark matter.
Yes.
What is dark matter exactly? It's just something made up because our current understanding of the universe, our current model, it has some like severe shortcomings.
There's problems.
Yeah. So we're just gonna make up some placeholder forces of nature that we like galaxies. They can look up at the sky and they can look up at a galaxy and they can kind of estimate what its mass is. And they can look at how it's traveling, how it's rotating. And what they found was, given the mass of this galaxy, of everything in it, you know, and how fast it's rotating, it should be just flying apart. There's not enough gravity to hold it together. So what's actually holding it together? So they just invented something called dark matter. Yeah. Dark matter is providing the additional gravity. What's dark matter? We have no idea. You know, the fact that electricity and electromagnetic fields play a greater role in structuring things than we realize, could that account for holding together rather than something just made up?
Like, yeah, and I mean, this theory's been around for a while, and it has been viewed as kind of woo and out there, a very different way of looking at cosmology, but it has been gaining kind of slowly more and more traction for the reason that it's kind of a neater, cleaner way of explaining the cosmos that does not require dark matter.
Yeah.
Right?
But we would have to kind of rethink all the other things we
Yeah. We, yeah. We, But apparently a lot of things line up and it works and it can work. And it's like, and there's even, they even talk about these, the potential for massive discharges, because Earth then would also be connected into this electric circuitry of the universe. All the planets would. And so they talk about as this massive, crazy cosmic event of these two stars coming close together and Earth and Mars being flung away from their host star and that host star dying. You know, there'd be these massive kind of arcing discharges, like mega lightning bolts that would shoot across the solar system.
That sounds terrifying.
And scar planets. And they're saying, you know, the Grand Canyon and the Valles Marineris are actually scars from these massive electrical discharges the size of the solar system.
That sounds like something out of H.P. Lovecraft.
It's wild, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I wanted to go. That's the stuff about this that I find really cool and interesting and why I wanted to go there. Obviously, I'm no physicist. and I have a hard time wrapping my brain around all the ins and outs of why, but it's really cool.
Well, you want to hear something cool? I was just kind of reading up on Voyager 1. You know Voyager 1. Everyone knows Voyager 1.
Yeah.
I was just kind of reading about it recently on how Voyager 1, they thought Voyager 1 was going to fail. It wasn't last year. It was in 2023 because they're still in contact with Voyager 1. It was launched in the late 70s, and it's still flying outward through space. It's in interstellar space now.
And that just happened recently, right?
Yeah.
Within the past 5 years or something, it finally, they keep pushing back the barrier of what they think the border of solar system is.
This is kind of where it gets into electric universe theory. But I mean, I'll come back to that. But yeah, they thought Voyager 1 was going to fail. Part of its circuitry was corrupted, and it started just transmitting like garbage data back. And this, it's amazing they can even still stay in contact with this thing, because it's so far away that it takes a signal 22 hours to get from us to Voyager 1 or back again. It's 22 light hours away, which is insanely far away.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's transmitting only with the power of your refrigerator light bulb.
Yeah.
Gives off more wattage than Voyager 1's transmitter. And they still stay in contact with it. And they actually had to like reprogram it and move a bunch of its software and programming into different areas of memory to basically program around this corrupted area of memory.
Yeah.
They had to reprogram it remotely over a signal that takes 22 hours to get, you know, there and another 22 hours to get back. But they did it, and Voyager 1 lives on. But Voyager 1...
And again, just that's kind of awe-inspiring that they could
that is a great triumph over entropy right there.
The amount we struggled just trying to get our audio software to work before the show. Trying to reprogram a spacecraft on the opposite end of the solar system, or basically a solar system away.
A spacecraft built in the 70s. that's just amazing. But you know that they're really keen on keeping this thing alive as long as, and it's finding such cool things. It's still showing us new things as it travels outward. This thing built in the 70s, because it's like you said, they keep redefining where interstellar space begins. So in 2013, Voyager 1 passed through what's called the heliopause, which is basically the boundary of where the sun's influence ends. That's the beginning of interstellar space. And what they found was that as it moved into interstellar space, it wasn't moving into this emptiness that they thought they would encounter there. Interstellar space is, what they found is, it's actually a medium that's filled with plasma This very reactive plasma, it reacts to our own sun, it reacts to the ship as the ship is passing through it, and no one expected that. That's one of the things, like, I know the proponents of the electric universe theory, they latched onto this, right? Because one of the things they... electric universe talks about is how, you know, interstellar space is just alive with this reactive and very structured plasma, and that's what Voyager 1 is finding. No one expected that, but this little machine from the 70s made it out far enough to actually poke at this plasma, and it reacted. Like, interstellar space is just alive with this reactive plasma. I found that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's really cool. I've always been fascinated with the Voyager probes. It's really fun because, yeah, when we're long gone, those spacecraft will still hold a record of humanity and the fact that we're here. Like, we could all die tomorrow.
Yeah.
And those spacecraft will still be out there traveling the universe. Keeping a record of our existence. Actually, when I think Teddy, our nephew, turned 1 year old, I got him a present for his birthday. It was the Voyager Golden Record.
Oh yeah,
On made vinyl. By
designed by our friend Carl Sagan.
That's right. Which is a fixture on the Voyager probe.
Yeah.
It's an actual vinyl record with an integrated phonograph. On the probe.
And instructions how to use it.
So if an alien came across that probe, they could play this record. It had sounds of Earth and certain musical pieces. Yeah.
And a speech by Jimmy Carter, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it was basically saying, greetings from Earth.
Yeah. And a little while ago, I think it was whatever anniversary, I don't recall, but they released this vinyl set of the Golden Record.
That's really cool.
Pretty cool. Yeah. I really love that sort of stuff. But just to circle back to electric universe stuff, so these plasmoids. Okay, so there's a UFO connection to these things.
Oh, okay.
Because the way these plasmoids behave, it's very similar to certain UFO encounters. The way they move around, like they can kind of dart around all over the place. They're super fast maneuvering speed. They're glowing orbs of energy, right? It's possible that some of the UFO activity you see is actually these plasmoids being created within our own atmosphere, and it's theorized that they could even be alive, that they could even be intelligent, because as these things, they form into their own kind of cohesive unit, right? It's like a cell, and that the electromagnetic forces kind of interact with each other and can kind of build and get more complex when it's contained that way within its own field in the plasma, perhaps. And we know with some UFO activity that we've seen, the thing people say is, well, it looks like it's intelligently controlled. Like it seems responsive and reactive to stimuli.
But so, what you're saying is it's not a ship. It's alive.
It's an entity. Yeah. It's an electromagnetic plasma entity that might be native to our atmosphere.
So it's not aliens.
Well, it sounds pretty alien to me. That's what it is. I mean, I guess...
Just not the aliens we thought.
Yeah, not the aliens we thought. You could call it a very exotic form of life that we didn't consider could exist before. But I thought that was really interesting. This idea that that our atmosphere could be home to these creatures that could be very different from life that we, as we understand it here on the ground. And in the rest of the Earth. What do you think about that?
You know, I think one of the reasons I just absolutely love all this stuff is the more we, especially space, the more we look into space and kind of poke at it, the more we realize we don't know about it. And it's like, you know, things like James Webb. Like James Webb, we could do a whole episode on James Webb, because every time they look at something, they seem to find something that rewrites our entire understanding of the universe.
Yeah.
And
it inspires wonder, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I know some people just can't be bothered to have interest, and to some people it comes across as very dry. I've never understood that perspective. Just even trying to wrap your brain around the scale.
Yeah.
The scale of the cosmos is mind-bending, right?
I got a great quote here from team members on the Voyager project. It says, we had no idea how much we'd still be discovering even now. Nature is far more imaginative than we are.
Hmm. Yeah. I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're never gonna figure it all out. But the more we figure out, it's always more interesting than we thought it would be.
I think we do kind of live in an age of kind of hubris and arrogance where we feel like we've figured everything out. Like we know so much. But yeah, I feel like we're still in a place where what we don't know vastly outweighs what we do know.
Yeah.
And we do need to, I think that's why you do need to be open-minded.
Yeah.
To ideas that could shake up the paradigm, right?
Yeah.
Because if we haven't got it all figured out, we haven't got it all figured out. And so you've got to leave room. You've got to leave room for new ideas to take root.
Yeah. And sometimes we do need to step back and re-examine some things we thought were true and maybe are not so true. I mean, you can point back to the past and you can point out all sorts of things people used to believe that they thought were absolutely true. We know better now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Like the Earth is not flat. Or is it?
Or is it?
I've got some.
We might flip flop a couple times.
I've got some literature you should read. I've got some websites you need to visit.
Yeah, of course. Terrence Howard. No, I don't think he's a flat earther. I don't want to defame him or disparage him. But you mentioned Proxima B. Okay, and I had a note about that. I thought I had notes on this new telescope. It's actually a ground-based telescope that they're building. I can't remember where. I think it's South Africa. Mm. But it's going to be, bigger and badder new telescope. And once it's completed, which I believe it's due to be completed in 2027 or 2028. But they're saying with the completion of this telescope, we should be able to definitively say if there's life on within one of the planets of Proxima B by 2030.
Oh, cool.
So it feels like we really are on the verge of some kind of renaissance when it comes to space exploration and space discoveries.
Yeah.
James Webb is a big part about that. They're building a new James Webb already that's going to be a bigger, badder James Webb.
Yeah, I think it's almost complete, actually.
So I feel like these discoveries are going to keep coming in hot and heavy over the next decade, and we are really going to get this proof. We're going to have these breakthroughs that our galaxy, and perhaps our very local galaxy, is very populated.
Yeah, we were talking many episodes ago about Oumuamua. I believe they're planning an intercept mission.
Oh, yeah?
When it, loops back around, they're planning an intercept mission so they can land a probe on it and figure out what this thing actually is.
Yeah.
That sounds really exciting.
Yeah, that would be really cool if they could do an intercept mission.
Yeah.
That actually sparked a memory. I did have a note about Pulsar Aerospace. Have you heard of Pulsar? No, they're a fusion company, but they also build rockets.
Oh, I've not heard of them.
I'll send you a video. Maybe I'll link to it in the show notes. The Angry Astronaut did a really good workup on this company Pulsar. So they're working on fusion energy, but they also are working on space-based technologies and fusion rockets, right? And so the thing about, like, we don't have functioning, scalable fusion energy. Right? We've had some breakthroughs in the field of fusion, nuclear fusion.
Reading a lot about it lately. You hear more and more stories about that they keep breaking records with fusion, seemingly every week.
Yeah, but it's not really real. It's not really here yet in terms of energy production.
Yeah, they can't scale it to what they would need to make it, viable as...
Yeah, but the thing is, if you're talking about a fusion reaction to power a rocket... If your goal is propulsion versus energy production, you don't necessarily need to have that perpetual power generation, right? That's that's not the aim. And so what they've got this design for like a module, a modular kind of nuclear rocket system.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you would have these module fusion rockets that would be set up on some kind of satellite structure or orbiting space station,
mm-hmm.
right? That so you can do the hard part of getting your rocket up to space on a launcher, right? Because you burn up all your fuel. 90% of what a rocket is the fuel just to get it into orbit out of the atmosphere. But then once your spacecraft ditches its thruster mm-hmm. stage to get it into orbit, these modular fusion rockets would be waiting
mm-hmm.
up in orbit, could attach onto your spacecraft and propel you, say, to Mars at a really high rate of speed. And that there would be another orbital station, say, around in the orbit of Mars with its own kind of supply of modular fusion rockets. That, mm-hmm. And the fuel could be produced cheaply in situ with resources on the surface of Mars. And it would basically set up so that when your spacecraft got to Mars, it's used up the first fusion rocket, ditches it, or releases the empty rocket onto the station in orbit of Mars to be refueled, grabs a new one for the return trip.
Yeah,
basically would be like a rail system. It'd be like a railway.
Or a relay.
Yeah, between Mars and Earth.
Okay.
Enabling very high speed travel and transit between Earth and Mars.
Interesting.
Right? So we could really be seeing the new frontier, you know? It's like like building the railroad across North America. Right?
I don't know if we should go to Mars, though.
Or wherever you wanted to go. It could be the asteroid belt.
Sounds like there's some bad aliens on Mars.
It could be the asteroid belt. It could be the Jovian system, you know? But it would open up corridors within our solar system.
Yeah, yeah.
Which would open economy. And
that's the same way, you know, expansion happened, you know, in North America.
In the Old West.
In the New World, you know. People just settled wherever the railroad went, you know. And if we were talking about ghost towns last week, you know, people plopped themselves down, you know, where the railroad was. And if the railroad moved out of there, if that section of the railroad went away, the town went away.
Yeah. Yeah, and like resource towns, right?
Yeah,
because
coal mining towns.
Yeah, every town we talked about, it was either a mining town of one resource or another, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And usually coal, because that's what was fueling the railroad.
And it was always right by the railroad.
Yeah, so we'll probably see the same things, where towns pop up just to harvest, you know, hydrogen or whatever else they need to drive the fusion process for these rockets and building kind of gas stations throughout the solar system.
Kind of makes you wonder, though.
The next 100 years are going to be amazing. Like, it's going to be like The Expanse. Like, I can't recommend that series enough. Book series or television. Both are fantastic.
But it makes you wonder how many abandoned ghost towns there are out in the stars.
Totally.
How many abandoned... Yeah. From railroad towns coal mining towns from other starfaring civilizations
that have died out. Yeah, that's a really cool idea. Yeah.
Just go ghost hunting there.
Space, yeah, totally.
Space ghosts.
Yeah, that's what the show will be in 50 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What else have I got?
Well, if you want to talk about space ghosts, we could talk about Phobos 2 briefly.
Right, yeah, Phobos. Absolutely. Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to touch on this because, I mean, we talked so much about Mars being a home to a dead civilization that left all these ruins everywhere. So I think we missed out on one of the most captivating stories from Mars that we could roll into that. So in 1988, the Soviet Union of the day, they launched a probe to Mars, and the idea was it was going to study the surface of Mars and one of its moons, Phobos. It made a very successful survey of Mars, and then it was going to move into position proximate to Phobos, and it was going to do some scans of Phobos, and it was going to land a lander on Phobos to test the soil. And then all contact was lost with the probe. But it sent back one final batch of pictures, which were very eerie.
Mm-hmm.
So the pictures showed this large rectangular object, a UFO, hovering above Phobos.
Was it rectangular or was it kind of ovoid?
It was rectangular.
Was it rectangular?
But a lot of people dismiss this as, oh, it was just the camera having a glitch.
Yeah.
This object, but the object casts a shadow on Phobos.
Right.
Like there
and,
was.
And glitches don't cast shadows.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, the probe failed. All contact was lost. The official narrative from the Soviet government of the day was the probe suffered some sort of, you know, systems failure and went spiraling out of control and lost all control and would have crashed into the moon. But then these pictures emerged of this craft hovering above Phobos.
Yeah, pictured right before the craft suddenly failed.
Yeah.
Where everything was going swimmingly before that.
Yeah, that's why I said maybe we don't want to go to Mars. It sounds like there's some...
Maybe there's a ghost gas station on Phobos, there. Right?
Well, that's one of the things you so often hear when people talk about UFOs, is that maybe like we're seeing UFOs on Earth or in other places in the solar system, and they might not even be interested in us humans, the civilization. They might just be interested in some resource the planet has,
you know,
something in our atmosphere, something in our ocean, something in our star. And they're just kind of, they don't care about us. They don't want to get in our way.
Yeah, they're just making a pit stop.
They're just refueling.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, it could be. Interesting. And there's the monolith that's supposedly on Phobos too.
On Phobos. And Phobos is just interesting because it's mostly hollow. Like it's not very dense. It's
got
dense.
A very, very low density.
It's either got it's either completely hollow or has large kind of hollow portions of it.
Yeah. Might make a perfect spot for an orbital kind of platform
and this
to
mission,
launch to the rest of the solar system.
But this,
just like what we're doing with our moon, how we want to build the lunar gateway.
It's just interesting that Phobos 2, it was the only mission ever planned that was actually going to land like a lander on the moon itself.
Yeah.
And then
it was a first attempt.
It's seemingly confronted by this other craft and all contact is lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we're not welcome on Mars.
Yeah.
Or at least not on Phobos.
And it's interesting. This is going back, and it's a weird, random connection that probably means absolutely nothing at all. But there was a piece in the Electric Universe stuff called Birkeland Currents, right?
Okay.
And this was basically describing the motion of the solar system through the galaxy, right? Which we see visualized, and it's all about... the structure of vortexes, right?
Yeah,
and how that plays into this whole electric universe theory, and they get these things called Birkeland currents, which are basically self-perpetuating spiraling currents, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is not a vortex, but it struck me. I was watching a video about it, and the animation they had for it, it creates like a cylindrical structure.
Mm-hmm.
Right, this Birkeland current with this spiral that goes around the outside. And I was like, that looks exactly like those structures that are supposedly beneath the Khafre Pyramid.
Ooh.
Right?
What does it all mean?
Probably nothing. Okay. that's what I was saying. I was going very Terrence Howard on the weekend, and I was drawing these schizophrenic connections between things that probably have no relation whatsoever. It probably just looks similar. But anyway, I just wanted to revisit the Khafre Pyramid thing because I'm still following that. Actually, that guy I mentioned with the YouTube channel, Trevor Grassi.
Okay.
he had a new video updated where he's interviewing Biondi and Malenga.
Okay, yes, those are their names.
Right? Kind of going over more evidence or more proofs that their technology actually works. And it was honestly, it was a really boring interview. And it was really hard. It did it in English, but you could tell that that was a struggle for the Italian guys. So I didn't get a lot out of it, but it was really interesting to see that that story is still developing.
Yeah.
I do feel like it did kind of reaffirm some validity for me. I believed these guys a little bit more just watching them for an hour and a half being interviewed.
Yeah.
You know, you just start to get a sense of people a little bit more.
And, yeah.
Are they genuine or do they look a little off or what? And it helps give me a little bit more confidence that there might actually be something genuinely interesting going on there.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's frustrating for me to watch stuff like that. Like even this exoplanet, K2-18b, I was listening to an interview by the guy who headed this study. I believe his name is, I'm going to butcher this, Niku Medmuston.
Well done.
Is that even close?
I have no idea.
I was trying really hard to listen to an interview with him because this is so fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, but he was talking in such a technical way. I found it like really, really hard to follow. I wish I was more technically minded like that. I would probably appreciate this so much more.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, kind of get a read on the man and his character.
Yeah.
And, just like you said. Yeah. I just come on here and give my own primitive musings on the subject.
Totally,
not very technical.
No. Yeah. I feel like I did a disservice to the electric universe theory on this, on this episode. I should have done way more research. As always, but like I said,
you know way more about it than I do.
It's just cool. I just like the fun parts about it, right? I'm sure we'll revisit it. Maybe we'll do a deep dive on it later and actually try and
actually try
on that episode to do it justice. I'm sorry, folks. Yeah, we were both kind of distracted with other projects this week. So we're a bit of a mess here, you know. Yeah, I know you were working on something particular for a friend that took you away, and I was working on the show. I just wasn't working on the episode.
Oh yes,
I was just.
See, we got some cool stuff coming up, you know. We got. Yeah, I don't know where I was going. We got some cool stuff.
I actually got notes here for a whole other topic. That let's not go into, because I've only got one page of notes. It would be like 5 minutes. But I think I just stumbled across something else about human development, our rise into civilization. That can be another episode. Yeah.
But we've got some cool stuff coming up from us. We've got some really cool stuff coming up from our friend Loeb.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Loeb's been working hard, too.
Yeah, but we're not going to reveal that. Quite yet,
no,
apparently.
Maybe next week, maybe the week after. We just have a little more development and polishing to do on that. But yeah, exciting things happening in the background.
Man. Yeah, you're all going to like it, I think.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Well, do we want to wrap up?
Yeah, maybe just a final thought from me. For our friends here in Canada, you know, we have an election on Monday. I feel like it's a pretty important one. So if you didn't go vote early, make sure you get your vote in.
Yeah, absolutely. Monday. Go vote. Yep. Oh, and I wanted to do a shout out on this episode. I forgot at the beginning, but we've been trying to do shout outs to our fans. As frequently as possible, and to acknowledge the people that are supporting us. We're still a pretty small outfit, but it was our mom's birthday last week.
Yeah.
Right? Our mom just had a big birthday, and she's definitely one of our biggest fans. She always writes me after we drop each episode and lets me know what she thought and what she liked. So yeah, shout out to our mother. Happy birthday, Mom.
Yeah, happy birthday.
Okay, and with that, I think we can wrap it up. Sorry, we're a bit of a mess. We're a little off our game this week, folks. But I hope it was at least entertaining to watch us fumble around and try and make an episode out of this. But we've got a really good idea for next week. I really like...
next week's going to be good.
Do we want to tease that or we gotta keep it secret? Let's keep it secret.
Secret, yeah.
Let's keep that a secret for next week. But we've got to...
In case we change our mind.
Yeah, that's right. We can always change our mind at the 11th hour. But yeah, exciting. I think that'll make a really great episode for next week. So tune in next week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Get out and vote. And with that, we'll say good night.
Good night.